Bob Carlin's Record Ranch is made possible with a grant from the Philadelphia Folk Song Society. You can also hear Bob Carlin here on 91 FM every Saturday afternoon from 2 until 4 o'clock when he hosts Country Boy Rock and Roll. It's 11 minutes after 4, and this is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Bob Carlin returns to Fresh Air next Thursday afternoon at 3:40. We did get started a little bit late today because of the length of the National Press Club broadcast at 3 o'clock. With me now on Fresh Air for a return visit is humorist and reporter Calvin Trillin, who last joined us to talk about food after the publication of his book Third Helpings. The current American obsession with low cholesterol and health foods has not caught up with Trillin, who continues to travel around the country sampling rich and sometimes greasy regional and ethnic foods. His travels have also been the basis of his New Yorker magazine series, U.S. Journal, reports on subjects ranging from theme parks to the ferocious controversy in Reedley, California, over whether Reedley College should be allowed to change its name to Kings River Community College. Since he started the U.S. Journal series in 1967, murders have been a subject of recurring interest. He says these murder pieces are meant to be more about how Americans live than about how some of them die. 16 of these pieces have been collected in Trillin's new book, Killings. Trillin discontinued his U.S. Journal series in 1982, but he's still a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's also a humor columnist at The Nation. A collection of his Nation columns is published under the title Uncivil Liberties. Calvin Trillin's new book, Killings, is published by Tickner and Fields. And Calvin Trillin, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How did the U.S. Journal series start? Well, let me rephrase that. When you're on the road, what do you look for in a story?
Well, I don't go on the road till I find the story.
Oh,
for one thing.
So you find it in New York.
I find it in New York, or I found it in New York when I was doing that. I basically was on the road 1 week out of three, except for the summer, for those 15 years. But I didn't go any place until I thought there was a story there. In other words, I looked for a story someplace and then left on that Sunday night or that Monday morning and went to it. But I never just kind of wandered around looking.
Would you subscribe to lots of magazines and newspapers?
Well, I subscribed to, after the first 7 or 8 years, there came to be a sort of a paper around the country that was a weekly paper, sometimes called alternative papers, that I subscribed to. When I first started doing it, there was something called the Underground Press, which was basically useless for my purposes. But the papers like the Maine Times or the Boston Phoenix, and I subscribed to those. And then when I was on the weeks when I was looking for stories, I often went to the Times Square newsstand and just got the daily papers, and most of which were the same AP stories from Washington about the economy or something. But I would just travel around, bent under the weight of 30 or 40 pounds of papers most of the time.
Well, 16 of your pieces about murder are collected in your new book, Killings. Why do murders have special appeal to you? It's a subject that's recurred.
Well, I didn't really go out looking for murders. What I did, and I wasn't even sure when I began what I was looking for, but I decided after a few years that what I was doing was trying to write about the country without emphasizing government and politics. Occasionally did stories about an election, but only after the election was over, and they weren't about who might win. And on the other hand, I wasn't interested in the what I think of as Americana, what's called Americana, the last fellow who can whittle worth a damn in Jasper County. And I was most interested in doing stories about ordinary people, but ordinary people one at a time, as opposed to people as representatives of other people, like the typical farmer or the typical Detroit auto worker who has moved to the Sun Belt, something like that. So to some extent, I was always looking for an excuse to be somewhere. And murder or sudden death turned out to be a very good excuse. And I don't think it was until I had done half a dozen stories that concerned murder that I realized that the stories that often appealed to me most were the ones where somebody was killed, partly because a lot of shades are drawn when somebody's killed. Inquiries are held, trials sometimes are held, investigations are held, partly because a sudden death kind of gives shape to somebody's life, and you can see it. It gets kind of defined against the horizon where otherwise it wouldn't have been. And often it seemed to me that the best way to write about a sort of a life, the life of, say, a farm family in Iowa, or high life in South Florida, was to write about one person who had been killed or one person who had killed somebody. And the rest of it kind of seeped in from the sides.
When you go to a town because you've read about a murder there from a magazine or newspaper that you've clipped, do the journalists there think you're kind of crazy for reporting on a murder in a small town so that you can bring it back and write it in the New Yorker magazine?
Yeah. Well, maybe too polite to say crazy, but they do wonder what I'm doing there. I have different ways of judging a story than different responsibilities than the local newspaper. A local newspaper, or any newspaper, judges stories of sudden death in some very specific quantitative ways. How many people are killed makes it more people killed, the more important. How important the people are. That is, the death of the mayor is much more important than the death of somebody who lives in the slum. And how closely related the people are to the readers. That is, the crash of a Pakistani Airways plane in Pakistan with no Americans aboard is less of a story than the crash of a plane in New Jersey with a lot of Americans aboard. So often they would wonder what I was doing at the scene of a murder in which neither the victim nor the murderer is particularly important. And when the murder didn't really constitute any symbol of some trend that was going on in the United States or anything like that. So, yes, they would often say, what in the world are you doing here? Even though sometimes I had waited for months for the proper trial or something and thought it was the most interesting case I had heard of. Because the New Yorker is not the magazine of record. All newspapers are the newspaper of record, whether they call themselves that or not. The New Yorker is not responsible for reporting that a certain number of people got killed in floods in California. They can ignore that, ignore almost anything except the death of a president, really. And by the same token, they don't have to justify a story that is about, well, in, say, a high school girl in Knoxville doesn't get along with her family. The New Yorker isn't required to include what we used to call in the news magazine business a billboard paragraph explaining why you're interested in this. They don't have to say, in the case of a story I did in Iowa, this seems to be symptomatic of a trend of fairly disreputable people in small towns killing each other. I mean, they don't have to justify the presence. So in the New Yorker, I was able to look for ways of telling stories rather than stories that were stories in the sense that they were important.
Do you think that the stories you tell when you're doing a story about a murder is connected to murder mysteries?
Well, only to the extent that murder mysteries, at least the ones that interest me often, and I read murder mysteries sometimes, particularly on airplanes, the ones that interest me are the mysteries that give a kind of a sense of place. The obvious example being the old Southern California mystery. But I don't know, one of the mystery writers I like is just has a wonderful ear for an eye for what the Navajo reservation is like. And one of them is very good on South Africa. I'm more interested in that in murder mysteries than I am in whodunit. I'm not one of the people who reads them and on about page 80 starts wondering whether I've guessed the right person. And to that extent, there's something like murder mysteries. But they don't dwell on the mystery or they certainly don't dwell on the solution of the mystery. A lot of the stories in this book are killings that are, as far as anybody knows, unsolved And that is that maybe murders are unsolved, maybe a couple of them are accidents. Nobody quite knows why they happened. Often the questions interest me a lot more than the answers, both the questions that I have and also sometimes the speculation that people in community have about why something happens or who did it. That often seems more interesting to me than the real answer.
One of the murders that you write about in your book, Killings, takes place not far from here in Westchester. I mean, it actually there with Westchester is within our signal coverage, so it is here. What attracted you to the case of John Mervin, who had been with the Warlocks? And the Warlocks is a gang that I think like every 2 years there's a big story that breaks about them in the papers.
Well, somebody who lived in that town wrote me a letter saying it was a kind of an interesting case and sent a couple of clippings. I found it very interesting at the time. This was a story of a young man named John Mervin, and I think at various times it's been in the Philadelphia papers, various things about him. He was a member of the Warlocks, an outlaw bike gang, or whatever the proper phrase for those is now. He was also a member, he was also an undergraduate at the local college in Westchester. And this was in 1970, at a time when, to a lot of adults, a lot of what a lot of young people did seemed bizarre and threatening and seemed to be flouting the values that they had tried to teach people. And they thought of a lot of people at the college of acting in ways that they wouldn't approve of, and they certainly thought that of a motorcycle gang member. And he was arrested for shooting somebody in a roadhouse just outside of Westchester. It turned out he was out on bail from assault with intent to kill, which was another shooting where he had shot somebody in a parking lot outside of another tavern. People were quite up in arms at that time, and then the police chief said that, in fact, he was an undercover policeman who had been recruited from the Warlocks and had been instrumental in obliterating the drug traffic in Westchester, which was one of the things that the grown-ups had been particularly concerned with. And he became a hero, and he went around to the Kiwanis Club and Rotary, some places like that, and gave speeches on the wickedness of drugs, and was freed, I think, in 20 minutes in the trial, although there was some persuasive ballistic evidence that would lead people to assume that the story he told couldn't have been true physically. And I think of it as one of the stories in the book that's very much set in its time. Couldn't have happened in 1916, couldn't have happened in 1980. I think from the coverage, from the way that the jury treated Mervin and the way even the papers, even the Philadelphia papers, treated the case, there were a lot of stories about how he was an honor student and the first thing he did was to call his mother and tell her that everything was okay and that occasionally he had to use bad language in the course of his duties. And there was it was kind of taken for granted that practically everything previous to the time he had become a policeman was cover. Although even Mervin didn't claim that he had been anything but an outlaw biker when the police recruited him, and it seemed to me very persuasive evidence that a lot of people in Westchester and around Pennsylvania saw in Mervin what they were hoping to see in a lot of other young people, some of them their own children, which is that they would suddenly tear the masks off their own face and say, I am not this rather sarcastic and threatening hippie that you were afraid of, but an honor student and a former football player, and I intend to behave from now on, and all your aspirations for me will be met. I think that was a kind of a 1970 feeling that people had about young people. As you may know, years later, all of this kind of collapsed, and a reporter for one of the Philadelphia papers uncovered some evidence that, in fact, that story hadn't been true. There were a lot of other trials, and Mervin was eventually convicted of suborning perjury.
There's a lot of image confusion in there since the the people involved with your story have trouble distinguishing between a biker with long hair and a hippie with long hair. Since long hair means hippie. And then he cleans himself up for the trial, and people, as you said, assume that he has to be good underneath because he looks so good. He looks so authentically good. And I think that's really relevant to what's happening now with the whole, for instance, dress for success craze, in which people are studying up on how to look like you were born wealthy and born into the corporate world. It's a different kind of image, but there's still a lot of image being taught.
Yeah. All those things kind of blurred in Westchester. Of course, it's obvious that motorcycle gangs were, in fact, used by the police to break up peace demonstrations sometimes. And there wasn't any real connection between long-haired kind of peaceniks in a local college and motorcycle gangs. But to people then, middle-aged, living in a town the size of Westchester, I think any young person out on the street causing trouble was kind of the same. And, of course, Mervyn was this odd example of a combination of a number of things that they feared.
My guess is Calvin Trillin, and he's a humorist reporter, and he writes the humor column for The Nation. That's been collected. His columns have been collected in the book on civil liberties. His latest book is called Killings, and that's a collection of articles about murders that he wrote for the New Yorker U.S. Journal series. One of the stories that really disturbed me was about a filmmaker in Kentucky who was filming life in the Appalachians and got killed while doing it. Can you give us a capsule of that story?
And this was a man named Hugh O'Connor, who was a Canadian documentary filmmaker who was making a film for the U.S. Pavilion at Hemisphere. That was a World's Fair, World Exposition held in San Antonio. And he and his crew were in eastern Kentucky, poor Appalachian part of the state, and saw some people sitting on a porch in little shacks, went to film them, got releases from them, and suddenly a man appeared and said, "Get off my property," and started shooting at them. They thought actually he was shooting blanks, and somebody got hit. And then O'Connor, who was lugging a heavy battery across the road, turned to say that they were leaving, and the man shot him in the chest. Hugh O'Connor looked down, it was testified later, and said, "Why did you have to do that?" It's very surprised, which I think a lot of people in this book who got killed were very surprised, since a lot of them seemed to be doing pretty much what they had always done or what they could be expected to do. I'm sure that O'Connor had gotten releases and filmed thousands of people before that, and suddenly, for no particular reason, he got killed. Well, you could build a big case for suspicion of outsiders and in the hills and people who had been kind of exploited and made fun of and had really no reason to do anything but distrust outsiders. On the other hand, it wasn't the people who he was filming who shot him. It was the man who owned the property. And the other way to look at it was he went on the wrong man's land. This was a mean, nasty old man, and everybody knew that. All of his neighbors knew that. He had apparently once furnished a house for a bride. Either she backed out or he didn't have any bride in mind. It had sat there empty with a lot of furniture crated up for years. He had fired at some boys once, and the psychiatrist later said that he became very exercised at mention of the phrase game warden or Democrat would set him off. People around there knew not to go on his land. But, of course, an outside film crew didn't. In a way, as in a lot of these pieces, what happened was a matter of two sorts of people kind of rubbing up against each other, not knowing exactly how to behave, and somebody got killed.
It really makes you think about how fine the line is in ordinary life between having things go on in an ordinary way and somebody breaking one of the rules that you think are part of the accepted code of society, and suddenly you're dead, or suddenly something really tragic has happened.
I think that's true in a lot of these. Almost nobody in this book is anybody who you might think of as a criminal. ordinarily. I mean, a criminal class or a habitual criminal or the sort of person who breaks into stores or anything like that. They're ordinary people and not even particularly prominent people. I think except for Harvey St. Jean, a criminal lawyer in Miami, and who was killed, and Lawrence Hartman, a farmer in North Grundy County, Iowa. I don't think very many of them were even prominent in their own community, weren't known. They were just ordinary people, and usually going about their business in an ordinary way, or at least responding to whatever happened in the way you might expect them to respond. Most people were kind of acting in character in these stories.
Did covering these stories make you feel lucky to be alive, or scared that that any minute something completely unpredicted could happen?
It made me feel, as you said, that everybody, at least in this country, is vulnerable to something like that happening, partly because of the wherewithal in this country, the huge cars, the widespread accessibility to weapons, partly because the elements of the society rubbing up against each other, I think that's become more prevalent in the last 20 years as various barriers have been broken down, barriers which probably shouldn't have been there in the first place. I don't mean that that's bad. But I thought it was interesting. One of the stories is about a young man in Savannah who was from a prominent family. And he was one of these kids who put in a semester here and a semester there and didn't seem to do much wherever he was and hung around a lot at the bars in the kind of restored shopping district where they had beer parlors with funny names and went to the racquetball club and may have had a little marijuana here and there. He was kidnapped and then killed by someone he knew. And one of the friends of his family said, it used to be we didn't have to worry about our kids knowing people like that. Well, in fact, everybody now has to worry about knowing people like that because everybody does know people like that. And also it struck me when I thought about it that the person he was talking about was from a respectable family himself. He was not as socially prominent as the victim, but his father was an accountant or something. He was a middle-class family, didn't live in the shack next to the railroad tracks or anything like that. So I think that one of the things that goes along with a kind of a fluid society is that an awful lot of people rub up against each other and that the average person now knows a lot of people who are capable of something like that. And this sort of thing isn't really confined to armed robbers who shoot convenience store clerks.
You did the U.S. Journal series for about 15 years. You recently gave it up back in 1982. Why did you stop doing it?
Well, I had done a lot of stories by that time. I guess somewhere between a couple hundred, 250, something like that. And I think I had done a lot of different types of stories. So that the sort of story that I might be looking at with a possibility of going to a place that might be a community dispute or a festival or a murder or any number of things. I think more and more often I was thinking I did one that was kind of like that a few years ago. So it was kind of narrowing the number of stories that would make me enthusiastic about leaving to do them. And I had done it a long time, and I thought I was just getting a little stale at it, and I was afraid I was about to the point of looking for easy ones, and I thought that might be a good time to quit.
My guest is Calvin Drillon, and his articles from the U.S. Journal series about murder have been collected in a new book called Killings, published by Tickner and Fields. Did you like being on the road?
I didn't mind being on the road. I actually got to some Holiday Inns the second and third time in those 15 years. I didn't mind that very much. For a reporter, it was not the worst way to be gone. If you face the fact that that's what you do for a living and you're going to be away from your family a certain amount of time, This was a kind of a short burst away from the family instead of 2 or 3 weeks at one time, which I think is difficult, particularly with kids. And I kind of liked meeting an entirely new set of people every 3 weeks, so that one story I might be dealing with people in a labor dispute in San Antonio, and 3 weeks later I might be talking to people at a catfish festival in Florida or something like that. So that that was interesting, and I liked that. I liked the kind of constant change and the different parts of the country. So I didn't really mind the traveling very much.
When you travel, if you have a choice between a small hotel or an inn and one of the chain motels, which do you prefer to stay at?
Well, it would horrify you. I would stay anywhere except an inn if I was working, simply because whatever its charms, they usually aren't charms that are efficient for somebody who's in town reporting a story. And if the same very nice, sensitive, reasonable woman with good taste is both manning the checkout desk and handling the telephone and occasionally showing people to breakfast, and you have to make 14 telephone calls in a row, you're better off in some dreadful place where you can dial 9 and do your telephoning. I mean, it's just as simple as that. So sometimes the places that I would have stayed if I had been on a weekend with my family were not the sort of places I stayed when I was traveling. I always wanted a place where I could call out and get my hands on my car, a place that where you actually had a lot that you could go get your own car and leave when you're ready to leave and park it yourself when you came back, and a place where you could dial on the telephone, and then a place where you could take messages. It's just so much of reporting seems to me luck and chance. The guy's home, or you happen to be when he calls, or something like that. So a lot of those things, it seems to me, you have to kind of try to increase the percentages whichever way you can.
What about food? When you'd be writing for the New Yorker U.S. Journal series, would you use those same trips to sample regional food? Would you mix both those kinds of business together if you were, say, writing a piece about a murder?
Well, not exactly. I think maybe my interest in writing about food came from being in so many strange places and not wanting to eat in the motel and not wanting to eat in that fancy restaurant that I came to call La Maison de la Casa House Continental Cuisine. So that in a way my interest in eating local things was defensive from the travel. Certainly a lot of things that ended up in the eating books were just experiences from, well, say, in Riverside, California, where I went to do a piece about that's in this book about two Mexican-American families carrying on a feud for several years, killing each other. I also ate in a kind of interesting restaurant called Zacatecas, which had nopales on Friday, cactus and crackling, which I loved. And I think I may have mentioned Zacatecas and nopales in a piece or a book or something. But then I would make separate trips to actually write food pieces. And the food writing really developed as a kind of a relief for me from doing a serious piece every 3 weeks. So it got to be kind of a way of doing a light piece rather than a serious piece.
It's funny because it's also what you've really become, I think, nationally famous for, is your food writing. Not that you're not nationally famous for your other writing, probably more people see your books about food than
New probably. Yorker. I think of it as I've always thought of it as a kind of a sideline. I don't think a reporter or a writer can sit there with his publicity person and manager and decide whether he's going to cross over from country to to rock or something like that. I mean, I think you have to write what you're interested in writing about, and then whatever comes of it comes of it. But I think partly because, with the exception of this book and a shortly after I started U.S. Journal, there was a collection after the first few years. And the first book I did 20 years ago, which was about the integration of the University of Georgia, except for that, all the books have been, in one way or another, attempts at humor, either the Nation column or comic novels or the eating books. So I think people who know me from books are more likely, from what they've heard or read about the books, think of me as doing that. Although what I think of myself as having done for the last 20 years is reporting with some things on the side.
Since you just brought up the Nation column, maybe we can talk about that a little bit. And a collection of your pieces from the Nation has been published under the title Uncivil Liberties. Do you think that there's any major differences between writing for writing a humor column for a leftist publication than writing a humor column for, say, a daily newspaper?
Oh, sure. Although I think I'm not sure if it may also be true of a rightist publication. There is a lot of freedom that I think, and I've never tried to write a column for a newspaper, so I don't know if this is true, but I think some of the things I say in the Nation column probably wouldn't be allowed in newspapers. I think, I've just turned in a column that's basically about President Reagan's intelligence, or capacities, I should say. And I think probably a newspaper column would kind of draw the line on some of those things, how far you could joke about whether or not, in fact, the president was dumb, sometimes I've said things about people personally that I think would probably not go in a newspaper, but I'm just guessing because I've never actually tried it. It may be, a lot of times people anticipate difficulties that aren't there. I mean, it turns out maybe that you might be able to write things for a newspaper that people don't write. What happened with The Nation is that a friend of mine became the editor of The Nation and said, would you write a column? And if he'd become the editor of New Republic, I would have written a column for New Republic. I don't think of it as exactly a political act, although I think if he'd become the editor of the National Review, probably we would have had problems. Although I could see writing a column for the National Review. That wouldn't bother me. And often now I kind of make fun of the readership and the Nation as much as the right. I mean, there's a now kind of a running character in the columns called Harold the Committed, who constantly asks me if I want the civilization as we know it destroyed in a nuclear holocaust, even though I assure him that I don't. And I've even offered to sign affidavits to that effect. He's the one who wanted one of my daughters to go to the village Halloween parade as Emma Goldman, and one of the other one to go as the danger posed to our society by the military-industrial complex. I said, Harold, we don't have anybody who can sew that well. I don't know what her costume would be. She decided instead to go as a chocolate chip ice cream cone with chocolate sprinkles. So I think of the Nation as an opportunity to write whatever I want, and I've assumed from the start that everybody's fair game, including the editor of the Nation, who I like to kid about, and whoever is in office, Democrats or Republicans or anybody. So, and that's a lot of fun. I enjoy that a lot. I think maybe it would be possible for a newspaper. I think somebody could do that.
Does Vic Nadovsky get offended when you make fun of him in the column?
I really think the only time he got offended or hurt, perhaps would be a better word, was when I wrote about his basketball playing. He didn't say this himself, but I have reason to believe that he was offended. Nadovsky and I used to play basketball together on Sunday mornings in the village when we were young and single. and what we called the Field of Honor, although the city had some other name for it, the Gansevoort Street Playground. And Navasky was a terrible basketball player, just dreadful, kind of two-handed set shots from the belt buckle, very bad. And he always said that he was on the second five of his high school basketball team. A little touch of verisimilitude. He didn't claim to be on the first five. We could never figure out how anybody who was that awful as a basketball player, even though he would occasionally win some awards at our award banquet. We had an awards banquet every year. We had a lot of awards that weren't based strictly on playing. We had Most Improved Jewish Player Award, and we had the Roy Cohn Award for the most specious out-of-bounds arguments. Occasionally, Navasky might win one of those, but he was an awful player. And I finally realized that there was one possible explanation. Navasky went to high school at a place called Elizabeth Irwin in New York, which has always been a progressive school, politically, full of progressive people, or, as I say to Navasky, pinko, in other words. And I finally figured out that in order to avoid sectarian disputes in the PTA, they may have had a balanced team. So they had a couple of Trotskyite guards and maybe a Stalinist center and a Shachmanite forward, something like that. And Navasky, who was by then probably taking people's lunch money in return for publishing their pieces in the school newspaper, was on the team as a token exploiter. That's the only way I've been able to figure it out. I was told Navasky was a little hurt about that. Not the token exploiter part, but the description of his basketball playing.
He wouldn't be hurt by the exploiter part?
Oh, I don't think so by now, no. I think since we call him Sticky Fingers Navasky, and some people think that has to do with his chintziness, but it really doesn't. It has to do with his having stolen these manuscripts of Richard Nixon's book and Gerald Ford's book. He stole Gerald Ford's memoirs, White House Memories of a Lucky Klutz or whatever they were called, and published some things and was sued by Harper & Row for $12,500, which at the time I said really was most humiliating thing that had happened, since no unfairly dismissed busboy these days would think of suing for less than $1 million. And suing Navasky for $12,500 meant that they thought he was not just a thief, but a small-time thief. They have since won the case. Navasky has won the case, although I went down to see at the district court level, he lost. I thought we called him Sticky Fingers Navasky because of the theft rather than his chintziness. And I thought things were going badly at the district court level when I saw that whenever Navasky took the witness stand next to the judge's desk, the judge kind of edged his silver water pitcher just out of Sticky Fingers' reach. Obviously thought he was dealing with a criminal. But since then, they've won that case.
Victor Navasky edits The Nation, where my guest Calvin Trillin writes a humor column. And his new book is called Killings, and it's a collection of his pieces about murders that were originally published in the New Yorker U.S. Journal series. I think you recently wrote a piece for the New Yorker about some taste testing that you did in France of American fast food.
Yes, my younger daughter and I decided to test the authenticity of the American fast food hamburger places in Paris. As you may know, they're tremendously successful there. I think one of the Burger Kings on the Champs-Élysées is the largest grossing Burger King in the world. And, of course, all Americans now, when they go to Europe, see a lot of American things, American jeans, and a lot of times you see T-shirts that say San Diego on them or Cincinnati or something, and a lot of orange and black sweatshirts that say University of Harvard on them or something like that. American things have become kind of a symbol of zippy, modern sorts of things. American English, I think, has now become the kind of lingua schlocco of Western Europe, but any kind of Americanism means just fast, zippy, trendy schlock. And so we thought we would test it out. I think authenticity would be a fair kind of description of what we were looking for. We knew, in fact, the first time, the first one we went into that had square hamburgers, we knew that they did not measure up. But we found that the French, if they really put their minds to it, could make round hamburgers.
Doesn't one of the fast food American chains make square hamburgers?
I'm told that. I was a bad judge, it turns out, of this authenticity because I don't go in those places very often. I'm kind of a slow food person.
Then it's pretty arrogant of you to try this, wasn't it?
I think it's probably fair to say it was arrogant, yes. Even more arrogant of my daughter, who insists on having everything just plain and would take apart one of those Big Macs and get whatever was left off with a napkin before she would eat just the plain meat and the bun. But, of course, you know, Americans are always worried about what Europeans think of America and always disturbed to find that French intellectuals are studying middle period Jerry Lewis movies instead of American ballet or something like that. So we thought we'd test it out. We figured we had the credentials anybody else had.
So who won and who lost?
Well, we at first agreed that Le Monde had been correct in giving the Prix de Hamburger to Whataburger. But then we got home, and my older daughter, who had laboriously translated this Le Monde piece from the French, said that, in fact, Whataburger did not win the Prix de Hamburger, that Burger King won the Prix de Hamburger. Burger King is known as La Maison du Whopper in France. So I don't know. I guess it was all mixed up at the end. We were all mixed up, and we were terribly full.
What kind of people did you see inside the fast food burger places? Was it mostly American or French people?
French people. And apparently also a lot of tourists from Northern Europe. It's cheap and also kind of, for young people in Paris, rather fashionable. And they're all in English. They use English words, almost any English word, and then they add burger to them. One of them has a hit burger, a hit cheese, a hit fish. And there's a Dallas burger that has a Dallas burger, Dallas cheese, a love burger.
Remember how in the Roy Rogers, the people who work there used to dress up in Western outfits and say, I forget what they said after they served you, but I once saw somebody throw somebody out of there and they said, "So long, partner." After they got him out
the
door.
These are not heavily themed. I thought that my feeling was that the French wouldn't be able to have a Burger King or McDonald's or any of these places, because the normal procedure is to line up in front of somebody and give your order. And as you may know, French line is triangular with the base of the triangle at wherever the business is being done. And so I thought there wasn't anybody who could rent enough space on the Champs-Élysées to have more than one or two lines. But once they get in there, they line up more or less the way Americans line up. The other thing that troubled me is that all of these things are based on the speed of handing out the food. And anybody who's ever dealt with anybody in France after you get to the front of the line and after you're able to distinguish which part of the base of the triangle you're in is that even whether you're trying to get an immigration visa or whether you're trying to check out a volleyball, that the guy at any moment is likely to start asking obscure, crazed questions and writing down the answer with a quill pen, grandmother's maiden name, and that sort of question. I expected that to happen at the Burger King, Maison du Whopper, but it didn't. They were very quick and American.
I'm surprised you went to Europe when you could have gone to Busch Gardens.
You mean to find...
isn't that how they advertise it, that, you know, it's Europe in your own backyard?
Oh, that's right. You know, a kind of packaged Europe.
You've made a tour, I think, of... Well, I know you've written about Sesame Place, but have you made a point of going to all the American theme parks?
Well, I've been to a lot of them. One of my daughters particularly, and really both of them, and I love to ride roller coasters. And my wife hates to ride roller coasters. And I think really after all kind of sex roles are obliterated in this country and everybody's doing everything and a lot of men are home washing dishes and everything like that, the one thing remaining will be the father taking kids on roller coaster while the mother says, how can you be so silly and you're such a child? That's certainly true in our family. So, we've been to a lot of those places.
Do you think that you would have done or been exposed to a lot of the things that you have if it weren't for the fact that you needed to be there to write about it? If you didn't have that compelling you to...
No.
...to get to places and experience things and taste things?
Oh, no. I think... I think that whatever other sort of writing I've done, like the Nation column or like any kind of commentary or a couple of these allegedly comic novels, they're all based on reporting. I mean, they're all based on what I've seen and what I've gathered from reporting. So if I didn't do that, I think that... I would kind of collapse from the outside. I mean, there wouldn't be any center of what I did.
So what kind of pieces are you going to continue to write for The New Yorker?
Well, I hope there'll be pieces. I think I'll always write the sort of piece that I wrote in Paris about checking out the hamburgers if I'm somewhere with my kids or something like that. But then I think I'd like to write pieces that, to a certain extent, like these murder pieces, maybe somewhat longer, although not a lot longer, that tell stories. Because I think The New Yorker gives you an opportunity to do that.
Well, I enjoy your writing, and I'm really glad you were able to visit with us again on Fresh Air. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Calvin Trillin has been my guest. He's a reporter and humorist. His humor column appears in The Nation. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, where he used to write the U.S. Journal series. He gave that up a little over a year ago. And 16 of his pieces about murders that originally appeared in the New Yorker U.S. Journal series have just been published in a new book called Killings. And Killings is published by Tickner and Fields. Calvin Trillin's recent book of collected food writing is called Third Helpings, and his columns from The Nation have been collected under the title Uncivil Liberties. The new book, again, is called Killings, and that's published by Tickner and Fields. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. We had just had a Tacony-Palmyra Bridge opening at 4:33. Traffic is a little heavy in both directions. You might want to take the Betsy Ross or the Burlington-Bristol bridges as alternates. No scheduled openings this afternoon on the Burlington-Bristol Bridge. An accident being cleared up in Pennsauk in Camden County, right around the airport circle. Use caution there. Also, westbound on the Schuylkill Expressway, some slow going from the Twin Bridges out through west of city. Northbound I-95 slowing for a half mile approaching the Ray Street merger. And if for folks heading to the airport area on westbound 291, some slow going for a half mile approaching Bartram Avenue. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Jim Battalese.
The Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Don Rosen Subaru. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, I'll speak with poet and translator Richmond Lattimore, who's just received an award from the American Academy of Poets. At 3:30, we'll be joined by classical violinist Shlomo Mintz and classical pianist Paul Ostrovsky, who are both recent emigres from the Soviet Union. And at 4:15, I'll speak with Toni Bentley, author of the book Winter Season, A Dancer's Journal. She's a former New York City Ballet du Corps dancer. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. This Sunday at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll hear from exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus and from Marita Golden, an American black activist who was living with her husband for a couple of years in Nigeria and wrote a memoir about the life of an American woman in Africa. So that's this Sunday at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air. Bob Carlin contributed to today's show. Joyce Lieberman was the technical director. Assistance contributed by Jeffrey Foreman. Maeve McGordon is the associate producer of the program. Danny Miller, the co-producer. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
Behind these words is a man who led and fought in combat for 1,000 days in Africa and Europe.